ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas, ACT Radio. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also discuss why a plant-based diet is the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we have another conversation with Dr. Melanie Joy. But first, some news.
From the Associated Press, Mexican authorities say a tiger mauled his trainer to death at a circus in northern Mexico. Police in the northern state of Sonora say the 35-year-old trainer was attacked in the Sonora town of Echahoa. Amateur video of the attack was circulated on media sharing sites, showing the trainer circling the tiger and making the animal turn slowly on a low platform. On one pass, the tiger suddenly stops his spinning routine and reaches out and grabs the trainer. Other circus employees immediately came to his aid, trying to drive the tiger off by hitting him with a metal stand. However, the tiger continued attacking, and the trainer died at a hospital of blood loss. The tiger was subsequently euthanized. This is yet another incident where deaths of a human being and a tiger could have easily been prevented. The simple solution is to stop supporting businesses that put wild animals in cages for profits.
Monkeys can be kind to their neighbors, and they have a specific brain region which appears to record their good deeds. Monkeys might not be known for their generosity, but when they do seem to act selflessly, a specific area in their brains keeps track of these kindnesses. The discovery of this neural tally chart may help scientists to understand the neural mechanisms underlying normal social behavior in primates and humans, and might even provide insight into disorders such as autism, in which social processing is disrupted. Dr. Stephen Chang and his colleagues from Duke University in North Carolina monitored neural activity in three areas of the brain prefrontal cortex that are known to be involved in social decision-making while monkeys performed reward-related tasks. When given the option either to drink juice from a tube themselves or give the juice away to a neighbor, the test monkeys would mostly keep the drink. But when the choice was between giving the juice to the neighbor or neither monkey receiving it, the choosing monkey would frequently opt to give the drink to the other monkey. In another new study by the European Research Council, it was found that bonobos often share food. Sharing is thought by many to be a uniquely human concept, along with the belief that non-human animals are driven by self-serving interest. However, this study, based on experiments with wild-born primates in a sanctuary setting, showed that bonobos are anything but selfish and will share food with complete strangers, even more often than with members of the same group. According to the authors of this study, the sharing seems predicated on the possibility of new social interactions. Stay with us. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature another conversation with Dr. Melanie Joy, author of the book Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, and founder and president of the Carnism Awareness and Action Network. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us once again on Animal Concerns of Texas, Dr. Melanie Joy. Thanks for being with us again, Melanie.
Well, thanks for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
On our last show, we talked about carnism, which is the invisible belief system that enables people to continue to eat meat and to not be aware of what they're doing. Would you like to expand on that a little bit, Melanie?
Sure. Carnism is the invisible belief system or ideology that conditions us to eat certain animals, and this also includes the products procured by their bodies, such as dairy and egg products. Carnism is essentially the opposite of veganism. We tend to assume that it's only vegans and vegetarians who bring their beliefs to the dinner table, but when eating animals is not a necessity for survival, then it is a choice, and choices always stem from beliefs. You know, most of us don't, for instance, learn to love dogs but eat pigs because we don't have a belief system when it comes to eating animals. Now, carnism, a couple of things about carnism that are important for people to understand is that it's a dominant belief system or ideology. That means it's invisible. It's entrenched. It's woven through the very structure of society to shape norms, laws, beliefs, behaviors, etc. And it therefore becomes internalized. It shapes the very way that we think and feel about eating animals. Carnism is also a oppressive ideology. It's organized around violence. Meat cannot be procured without killing. And dominant oppressive or violent ideologies such as carnism need to use a set of social and psychological defense mechanisms to enable humane people to participate in inhumane practices without fully realizing what they are doing. Carnism teaches us how not to feel when it comes to eating animals.
You know, when I was a vegetarian, and I know a lot of vegetarians that still think this way, that, I'm not killing animals when I eat dairy products and eggs. It wasn't until years later that I'd been a vegetarian for 20 years that I really discovered that the animals who suffer most in animal agriculture are the dairy cows and the egg-laying hens.
Well, I mean, arguably, dairy and eggs are two of the most brutal of the carnistic industries. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, I became a vegetarian before I became a vegan as well. I stopped eating flesh and eggs immediately, and then several years later I stopped eating dairy because I really bought into this myth that because it's possible to procure dairy without necessarily killing somebody, somehow this practice wasn't harmful. And it wasn't until I recognized the inherent cruelty and brutality of the dairy industry. I mean, whenever we turn someone into something, whenever we reduce someone to a unit of production, we will inevitably be valuing the profits that their body turns over their welfare. And, you know, clearly this is the case in dairy and egg production. And so it's very easy to buy into the myth that dairy and eggs cause less suffering or less harm to animals, but that's absolutely not the case.
And we're also buying into the myth that milk does a body good and milk builds strong bones and eggs are the most perfect food. Propaganda by the industry.
Absolutely. And, I mean, if we think about it, you know, carnism conditions us to eat certain animals. And what it does is it blocks our natural empathy, our natural thought processes and our natural empathy when it comes to the animals that we've learned to classify as edible. It teaches us to classify a tiny handful out of thousands of possible species as edible. And all the rest we classify as inedible and thus disgusting to consume. We see this in meat-eating cultures around the world. So that even though the type of species consumed changes from culture to culture, members of all cultures tend to find their own choices to be rational and the choices of other cultures to be irrational and disgusting and often even offensive. And this applies to dairy and eggs as well. So just as the average American, for instance, would be disgusted at the idea of eating a golden retriever, but not necessarily at the idea of eating a chicken or a pig, they would also be disgusted at the idea of drinking, for example, horse's milk or pig's milk rather than cow's milk, or disgusted at the idea of eating crow's eggs or pigeon's eggs rather than hen's eggs. So we still have this selective way of thinking of what or who is appropriate to consume.
You know, speaking about propaganda, you know, it seems that, I mean, that's the real challenge, is that there's all these messages in our society that say meat and dairy are the way to go. And then when vegans or vegetarians or anyone in the spectrum tries to challenge that, the carnistic culture will turn around and say, you know, sort of demands that we know everything about every issue and how we're supposed to fix everything and how we need to live a certain way. I mean, it certainly puts a lot of pressure on us to try to explain ourselves and fix everything. How do we try to combat this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, in my recent article that we talked about on your last show, Speaking Truth to Power, this is exactly what I talk about. I talk about not only the way that the system that is Carnism defends itself and maintains itself through promoting fictitious stories that distort the truth about farmed animals and people who eat animals, the impact of animals on our bodies when we eat them. It distorts the truth around that, but it also distorts the truth about vegans, vegan ideology and practice, and the vegan movement as well. So these dominant stories they're fictions. The dominant story, the stories of the dominant animal eating culture are fictions. They're fictitious stories that are designed to make us believe the myth that eating animals is the right thing to do, that it's good for us, it's not bad for the animals, and it's the normal, natural, necessary way of life. Those who challenge the fictitious stories, and this is true of all social movements throughout history, there have been, you know, those who have stepped out of the dominant system to, you know, speak truth to power, to replace the fictions with facts, to share the truth of what is happening to the animals, for instance, or the truth of what they've discovered has been happening to the environment and to human consumers of animals, are often silenced by the dominant culture. One way that we're silenced is through the use of projection by the dominant culture. Projection is essentially shooting the messenger. When projection, in this case, it exists to invalidate vegans and therefore our message. Projection tells the story that, you know, vegans are wrong. So if we shoot the messenger, we don't have to take seriously the implications of his or her message. You actually mentioned two types of projection, each of which I'll speak to just briefly. One kind of projection has to do with the qualities of the dominant culture, in this case, the qualities of carnistic culture. So vegans might be portrayed as either possessing the undesirable qualities of the culture. So, for example, we're seen as biased and extremist when we challenge the biases and extreme practices of the dominant culture. And we're accused of propagandizing when we challenge carnistic propaganda. This is a way of silencing the voices of minorities who challenge the dominant fictions. Or we may be portrayed as lacking the desirable qualities of the culture. So, for instance, we're seen as overly emotional and sensationalist when we challenge the apathy and numbing of the dominant culture. So this is a way of, again, silencing the vegan message, but it is a form of projection.
I've bought into this idea that I have to be a perfect vegan and not have leather shoes or leather belts or wallets or watch bands. And there's a lot of variety in the vegan culture. We're not all the same, and we're not stereotypes.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And so, you know, you're actually mentioning a couple of different defenses, one of which is a projection. And sometimes carnistic culture projects onto vegans an image of omnipotence. You know, the suggestion here is that we only have a right to our ideology if we can live up to an impossible ideal. So we're expected to be paragons of health. And this is something that I talk about a lot, that there are thousands of vegans around the world have told me that they hide the fact that they're sick from people in their lives. They're worried that it'll be used as an excuse to discredit their veganism. Or sometimes we're expected, as you pointed out, to be paragons of virtue, you know, with the moral consistency of the Buddha. So we talked about leather. You know, we're hypocrites if we wear leather, even if it's used, but we're extremists if we don't.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're expected to be experts on everything. You start out talking about veganism, and people start asking you about agricultural economics. They ask about veganic farming, and what about fertilizer? They might ask you about quantum physics. I mean, it's almost as if we don't have a right to advocate veganism if we don't have all the solutions to the problem of carnism. And when we, of course, don't live up to these projections, then it becomes an excuse to invalidate everything we stand for.
Uh-huh.
So we end up being the token vegan. We're the ambassador for the entire movement, for better or worse. And this is just a tremendous amount of pressure on us. And if we buy into the fictitious story that we can and should be perfect, and that we are somehow solely responsible for the success and failure of the movement, then we inevitably feel this responsibility to turn everyone around us vegan. And we can feel like we've failed the animals if we don't. And this is total role reversal, if you think about it. And this is the way that certain types of what I call secondary carnistic defenses work. They turn the problem of carnism around and pin it on vegans. One real problem, though, apart from just feeling the burden of having to be advocating veganism all the time, which really is an unnecessary burden and leads to a lot of burnout and frustration and misanthropy, and, you know, it's just unrealistic. Colleen Patrick-Goudreau, you know, wonderful author and a friend of mine, says, our goal as vegans is not to turn people vegan. It can't be. You can't make people change. Our goal has to be to plant seeds. And we do this, you know, I would suggest we do this by living and speaking our truths to the best of our ability. But sometimes what vegans do is they react to this projection of omnipotence by believing that they are indeed all-powerful, or that their particular brand of veganism is the perfect ideal. And when they do this, they can end up projecting onto other vegans that the other vegans are imperfect and somehow wrong. So there's this righteousness, you know, that often leads to fundamentalism and ideological rigidity that evolves from this projection. And this is a problem that plagues activists in many social movements, but that is certainly a problem for vegans. I mean, we are, as a group, you know, often hard enough on ourselves when we don't live up to our own internal, you know, standards of perfection and desire not to harm animals. The last thing we need to do is to be shaming each other or making each other feel like hypocrites because we're not, you know, quote unquote, vegan enough. I think it was you, Greg, who mentioned this idea that we're, you know, supposed to be. It was you, Greg, who mentioned this idea that we're seen as this homogeneous group, and this is a problem that plagues, you know, all so-called minority or targeted groups. And as vegans, we are in fact an ideological minority group. And what happens is that the dominant culture tends to de-individualize members of minority groups. In other words, they tend to look at us as though we are one homogeneous group. You know. Oh, you're a vegan, you're somehow all the same. And if we buy into this projection, then we believe that we should all be the same. And we end up becoming very frustrated when we recognize that we are, of course, just as diverse as members of the dominant culture as we should be. We end up looking at our differences as weaknesses rather than as the strengths that they are.
I mean, I think going back to the neocarnism that you talked about, one thing that I found really empowering is when you know, vegans are put on the defensive, or if I'm asked a particular thing, you know, you turn it around and you say, okay, well, why should I eat meat, or why should I eat this, and why should I do that? And it really changes the whole dynamic of the conversation. And all of a sudden, you know, when you're not trying to defend everything, I think it really challenges people to think about what they're doing in a different way.
Well, you're right, and you mentioned neocarnism. Neocarnism is the term that I use for new forms of carnism that are evolving as the vegan movement evolves and challenges the carnistic status quo, that the dominant culture. And, you know, one thing that happens is that, you know, rather than, you know, as you explained, is when we get into conversations as vegans, you know, very often, rather than a person who's not vegan explaining why they do eat animals, vegans end up in a position to explain why we don't, or justify or defend why we don't eat animals. We can end up being put on the defensive. So it's very important to recognize that carnistic defenses, as I mentioned, are internalized. And, to you know, it's so important for us to be able to maintain compassion towards people who are with whom we're communicating, vegan or non-vegan alike, and to kind of expect some of this defensiveness as inevitable and natural, a natural outgrowth of being, you know, born into this dominant culture. At the same time, it's very important for us to make sure that in the process, we are not being disrespected. We are not having these defenses projected onto us in a way that is making us wrong for who we are, just as we need to be careful not to do that to other people as well. So I always recommend to vegans, and in fact, I recommend this to everybody, learning the principles of nonviolent communication.
I think that's a very important point, and I find myself getting defensive when I really should just recognize these defensive mechanisms that carnists have and not let them affect me like I sometimes do.
Yeah. It's very difficult not to let them affect you in some ways. I mean, it depends. I mean, if somebody is defensive and disrespecting you, that's going to affect you, as it should. You know, anger is, if you get angry about that, that's not necessarily problematic. Anger is a normal, natural response to injustice, being treated unfairly. But it's what we do with the anger. It's if we take care of ourselves, if we make a commitment to becoming the kind of person, as Gandhi would say, becoming the change, if we make a commitment to becoming the kind of person or cultivating the kind of qualities inside of ourselves that we're looking to cultivate in the culture as a whole, then we're much less likely to be reactive in these conversations and much more likely to be able to be proactive.
Right.
When we practice reactive veganism, essentially what we're doing is we're looking at the world through the lens of carnism, generally as vegans, through the sphere of secondary defenses, the defenses that are constructed to invalidate vegans and veganism, these stories that most vegans are unaware of, and we're reacting to its stories. When we practice proactive veganism, that's essentially it's embodied activism. It's taking our activism and living it out and practicing it in our bodies and our minute-to-minute lives. And, you know, learning the principles of nonviolent communication is really essential to being able to do this because it helps us to approach situations in a way that increases the chances, the likelihood that our message will be heard, and decreases the likelihood that we will be triggered and become reactive and angry when we're interacting with non-vegans. And when we practice proactive veganism, really, we're practicing what the Buddhists might call mindfulness. We're able to step back from our emotions to a certain degree or witness our emotions without letting them hijack and consume us.
That's an interesting thought.
It's an interesting thought, and it takes practice, but it's the one thing that we can do when we're mindful. When we're mindful, we are playing the role of witness internally. We're not just witnessing the other, but we're witnessing ourselves.
Uh-huh.
You know, and step back and say, you know, let me see how I'm feeling. Let me pay attention to my feelings. And if you can witness your feelings, you unblend from them. You give yourself a little bit of space. So you notice yourself getting angry. You're looking internally and you're saying, what am I feeling now? Why am I feeling this way? You're practicing the C's, you know, and I talk about in my article and in much of my writing, the three C's are actually the four C's, which are fundamental to living, seeking and speaking and living our truth with integrity toward ourselves and others. We practice the C's of a balanced mind and heart. So we, for example, approach situations with curiosity, which is an open mind. We approach situations with compassion, which is an open heart. We seek clarity, which means looking deeply within ourselves to become clear about, you know, what am I thinking? What am I feeling? What's really happening in this interaction between myself and the other or between myself and myself? And sometimes seeking clarity involves often. It means connecting with others whose integrity we trust, who can give us feedback on our experience so that we can hold on to our authentic truth, our own story, when it's being challenged, but also be willing to examine our own truth and our own story and see where we may be having distortions.
Right.
And another C that we practice is courage, the courage to bring the other C's into our lives and our world on a minute-to-minute basis. And so we need to practice these C's not just toward others, but toward ourselves as well. And one good practice, you know, that I really try to incorporate in my own life, and, you know, I've mentioned this before, I have a tattoo on my wrist of the C's. It's an ever-present reminder. Because I feel that it's just so incredibly important. In fact, to me, it's really the essence of practicing integrity in my own life. And so when I'm in a situation, if I'm interacting with somebody and I'm noticing, you know, whether it's about veganism or, you know, some other dynamic, if there's some sort of a tension between myself and somebody else, if I notice myself starting to not feel curious about that person's experience, to notice that I'm more interested in, you know, communicating why I'm right or why I've been hurt by them or communicating, you know, what I want them to know, and I'm lacking in curiosity about them, or I'm lacking in curiosity about why I'm feeling the way that I'm feeling, or if I notice that I'm upset with somebody and I might be angry enough so that I don't feel compassion for them, that I'm not really connected with their suffering in that moment, I'll step back and just say, I can't talk to you right now, you know. So sometimes that's what we need to do as vegans. We need to pay attention to what's happening. When we lose touch with our C's, to ask ourselves why and what do we need to reconnect with our C's. And sometimes that means just, you know, taking a break from the conversation. Sometimes it means, you know, just taking a break, period, and not interacting with our family members or the individuals who, you know, we may be having difficulty with for a period of time until we can regain our footing and then reapproach the situation and bring that integrity to it that every situation needs and deserves, as do we.
One thing I really liked is, and speaking to Greg's point about anger too, is in the article when you said empathy is the antidote to anger. I think that's really poignant because we have, amongst vegans and vegetarians, we generally share this trait of empathy and how to take that skill and use that to a positive in dealing with people who share a different view from our own, I thought was very empowering.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. Empathy really is the antidote to anger, and that's another thing that we can do when we're in situations. If we notice that we're angry, once we notice that we're angry and stop ourselves and say, okay, wait a minute, am I empathizing with this person? And chances are, if we're not empathizing with someone, we're not able to feel compassion toward that other. So, and that's a good reminder. This takes practice, but the more we practice it and the more we practice, the principles and skills of nonviolent communication, the easier it becomes and the less likely we are as vegans to burn out, the more likely we are to have sustainable lives and to feel more empowered as vegans and also as just individuals, as beings on this planet. You know, one thing that leads to this kind of frustration and anger and burnout that can make it so difficult for us to empathize with others is we often, when we believe in the fictions of the dominant culture, that particularly the fiction that the vegan movement, for example, is weak or that the vegan movement it's non-existent, it's not thriving, that individual vegans cannot and do not make a difference, we can feel so despairing and so frustrated. You know, we can look at this problem and feel like the problem is just so huge and it's so overwhelming and, there's no way that we can make any difference. And this can cause us to feel very frustrated with people and become misanthropic and really just start hating humanity in some ways. But I would suggest, and, I'm in this very privileged position where I get to travel around the world and speak to large groups of meat eaters and meet with many, many vegans and vegans that are in positions of leadership in a variety of countries. And I hear very different stories from people, all of these different people, than the stories the dominant culture tells us. And I think it's really important for us as vegans to recognize that perhaps the greatest carnistic lie of all is the story that people don't care. It's the story that people eat animals, not because their hearts and minds have been manipulated by an invisible system that has coerced them into acting against their core interests, their core values, their own interests, and the interests of others, but simply because they don't care. And this, I can assure you, is not true. It is a lie. I see again and again and again. My talks are very often standing room only. I get standing ovations from large groups of meat eaters who come to hear about veganism, the truth about veganism. This is incredibly inspiring because this demonstrates that people care. They care about the animals and they care about the truth. And most people want to do right by themselves and by the world. And I think when vegans recognize this truth, this lie, and this truth, it can help them hold on to a sense of hope. And also, vegans need to recognize that there's a tremendous amount of momentum around the vegan movement right now. I mean, in countries, I was in Croatia recently and Slovenia, and I was talking to people there, and they're just telling me the same thing that I hear everywhere. 5 years ago, the conversation was very different. Today, people are starting to talk about vegetarianism and veganism in a way that has never been talked about before. And the movement is just really exploding in many places, not everywhere, but in many places around the world. And this momentum is really picking up. And the trajectory of growth is not changing. And I don't see the momentum slowing any time in the near future, if at all.
That's a wonderful positive thought that we will end this show with. We've been talking with Dr. Melanie Joy, psychologist, author of the book Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows, and founder of the Carnism Awareness and Action Network, which can be found at carnism.com. Thank you once again, Melanie. We appreciate you taking the time to be on our show, and keep up the great work.
Oh, and the same to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Lenny. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.